Hi,
Hi.
welcome everyone, and welcome Jennifer Stidley today to the TGA Tarot Talk podcast, episode 13. We've got Jennifer with her amazing tarot disassembled deck and a new deck about the symbols from the tarot that's completed on Kickstarter, and another deck in progress in the background. And we're going to be talking today about focusing a lot about the symbols in the tarot, Mardi Gras, different symbols for gender and sexuality, all sorts of things. We'll see what comes up. So, hi, Jennifer. So
Hi.
you're a karate teacher and a graphic designer and a deck creator. And so those graphic designing skills would have come in super handy when creating your own indie decks.
Oh, definitely, definitely. That it's funny. I mean, like being a graphic designer, I've been a graphic designer for over 25 years, and it's almost like just the last couple of years making total sense to me of why I chose that profession, because I really have always loved visual communication through symbols. And I think that's essentially the exact same reason I fell in love with tarot, like back in the 90s, a long time ago, when I first discovered that. So it's almost like now these passions and these interests are kind of intersecting, which is just really exciting. Because I think that's why I went down the road of graphic design, was it was that sense of using, especially logo design and things like that. You're basically making symbols and, that are easily visually communicating something. So yeah, so definitely they kind of merge.
Yeah, absolutely. And so with tarot disassembled, you've got all the different symbols from as this is how I understand it. And I'd love to hear more about how you describe the deck. You've
Sure.
got the symbols from the Rider-Waite-Smith or the Smith-Waite deck. You've taken all of the symbols from each card and then kind of remove them from the context or the situation that Pamela painted them in or drew them in, and arrange them in kind of so they're separate, so you're next to each other on the card, but they're all there still on the card.
Right.
Yeah. Is that
I
about the
oh, sorry, go ahead.
yes. Oh, do you have that there? Could you show?
Yeah, and I know that not everybody will see this on video because I mean some
Yeah.
people will be listening, so I'll definitely describe too. But here I'll just give you an example visually. Like in the devil card, here's an example where all of the symbols are just kind of broken out into a essentially a pattern of symbols now. And in my mind, like one of the biggest differences with my deck that from the other kind of Smith-Waite models is it really does take out that pictorial narrative. There's not really a scene anymore, and really honestly there's not even people anymore, with the exception of a few cards that it was really just essential to have a human figure in, which is the world and the hanged man, because they kind of that figure actually is a symbol itself in the way that they're shaped with their leg crossing over. So there were only a few, oh, in the tower, because again, you almost can't show the tower without the people kind of falling. Falling,
Yeah.
that's like a falling person. So so there's almost no humans represented in the deck. And in my mind, it wasn't necessarily where I started for the idea for it. I really mainly just wanted to break out those individual symbols so you could more clearly get intuitive hits on just the symbology. But then it occurred to me as I was creating it, it really kind of made it more open for and inclusive, because there's no ethnicities in the deck. There's no gender in the deck. It kind of strips out all those human constructs, and it really leaves it more open for anybody to read with it in a very intuitive, way with just the symbols.
Yeah. And we were discussing before we began about how we are in different hemispheres, and so those scenes are often set with weather and climate around.
Right.
And you're saying without the scene there, you don't have those cultural associations with the seasons necessarily, but with some of the symbols you can do that, like the grapes or the I don't know, fill in you know a lot better than
Well,
me.
like the Five of Pentacles, there is still that kind of that snow is actually pretty pivotal to the meaning of that card. being kind of trapped out in the cold. So there's a snowflake symbol on that card in my deck. Or the, definitely like you're saying, the grapes. So anytime there's those cards that have almost that spring summer feel, or what I would consider on my side of the world, spring summer feel of things growing and things, you know, being lush as far as abundance in the earthly plane, that, you know, like fruits and things like that growing, that definitely, the fruits are there, but again, not the overall landscape. So then again, like you said, it takes out some of that like seasonal, and it's more really about, well, there's grapes, because that growth, those grapes mean a lot of different things.
Yeah, and it's funny, like when you get closer to the equator, you get less of the four seasons. And in lots of parts of Australia, you know, we have six seasons, and colonial, the Commonwealth kind of British colonies coming over, we transported over the idea of the seasons from that area of the world. But really, our seasons over here are not four seasons in every single part of the continent. Because Australia is, as big as the USA continent, size-wise, distance-wise. So that variance, I guess you could imagine in the USA of, what summer in the very south or summer in the very north of the country would be quite different. You would have different symbols, different festivals, different types of crops, things people eat, all sorts of ways people dress, just from that distance, even though the nation or the cultures and subcultures might identify as being part of that same group of people, there's this variance in, symbols that you represent, that symbol that represent you and your culture and the subculture that you identify as belonging to. And we're talking about festivals, because it's February, the start of February when we're recording this, and Mardi Gras is coming up, which is, fabulous wherever you are in the world.
It's the festival of all festivals, right?
And we were talking about that in different places around the world, Mardi Gras has, is celebrated differently, and which cards would represent in the tarot, which cards would represent the Mardi Gras, and what symbols within those cards could be associated with Mardi Gras. So what are some of your cards that you associate with that festival?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is the Three of Cups. And then as far as a major arcana, honestly, kind of the devil. Not because I think there's anything evil about Mardi Gras, but because the devil also sometimes is that just extreme side of indulgence. And, kind of the really going overboard with like, how much can we push the boundaries of the wine and the celebration and kind of doing all the things that maybe we can't do on a daily basis to that extreme. So I think the devil in the extremes, and then the Three of Cups with that revelry and celebration. And again, the grapes show up on both of those. So I definitely think of the grapes a lot when I think as a symbol by itself, when I think of Mardi Gras.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I have the same association. Of the three of cups and the devil. I've also the Four of Wands. I also think of that celebration. It's not that kind of bacchanalian, excessive, Roman kind of what like orgy kind of style.
I was just gonna say orgy style, yeah.
Thing that I associate with Mardi Gras, that, eating to excess and drinking and sexuality and, that swapping of costume and all that sort of trying on different personas that come up with Mardi Gras, with celebrating Mardi Gras. But yeah, the Four of Wands is quite a conservative version of that, but it's still getting together and people coming together and putting up their
four. Celebrating. Yeah. It's definitely a card of celebration. I would agree with that. And revelry. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of joy in that card, you know, just of that kind of that joy of people coming together and partying, you know,
yeah.
like the joy of coming together for a reason, for any reason to celebrate.
Yeah. So in Australia, or at least the part of Australia I'm from, Mardi Gras, usually a rainbow celebration. It's like gay pride, LGBTQIA plus, you know, shining out there, getting out there and partying in a safe environment, protected, you know. We've got the you know, local police force that usually come out and protect everyone and
I love that.
Yeah. And you know, because when you have minorities coming out and expressing, they're usually, you know, for most of the year, they're usually oppressed in some way. And I suppose that's the thing about Mardi Gras, is that the Fat Tuesday, or the kind of celebration before Lent, in the Christian tradition, that's what I think Mardi Gras comes from, is that we were fasting, or we're about to fast, and we're about to famine, so we're going to have a huge party beforehand.
Exactly. Yeah.
keep us warm.
Right.
And so it's kind of that, yeah, that oppression, non, you know, expressive, generous, expanding, kind of those two opposite ideas.
Right.
If that makes sense. I don't know if that just
it absolutely makes sense. And actually, I love that tie, because I know you and I were discussing kind of privately just how different the vibe is of Mardi Gras in the States versus Australia. And I didn't even know it was associated so directly with pride. And we definitely have our pride celebrations in the States, but they're definitely not necessarily tied to Mardi Gras. They're kind of their own, you know, big, huge, amazing festivals and celebrations. But what I love is that word oppression, because I think so much of Mardi Gras, at least my understanding of it in the States, so much of its roots are, it was almost a little bit of a pushback to the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church really didn't even want, you know, obviously Lent would start and there's 40 days of, you got to eat fish, you got to be really, you know, there's a lot of that kind of, everything gets very, very ultra disciplined, if it's not already by the Catholic Church. And, you know, and the Catholic Church really didn't want the debauchery that was going to happen beforehand. They really wanted to temper that down too. So I think it honestly started from that pushback against, well, if you're going to make us do Lent, then we're going to really kick it up about 20 notches and do everything you don't want us to do before we hit that mark. So, so I like that there's that, a somewhat similar vein of fighting. It's because pride is all about celebrating and fighting, pushing back a little bit against some of that oppression and, you know, against people who, you know, they're with in the LGBTQ spectrum and what they face on a daily basis in the world. So I like that kind of tie, you know, that there's a little bit of a tie between that.
Yeah. And it's, it kind of links up with that, the oppression of nature in the form of a lack of abundance of food in the Northern Hemisphere, at least, with it being the end of winter. And so that's a kind of, I mean, oppression isn't, of course, the right word, but that same idea of, you know, nature is oppressing us. It's not giving us the bounty. We have to call for the bounty. And we, you know, by calling for the bounty, by being the bounty, we call it to us. We wake up the spring, you know, we call it. And so, like, pre-Catholic and Christian traditions around that time of the year, there was also celebration, you know, before Christianity, at that same time of year, about calling in the sun, calling in the bounty of the of nature.
Definitely. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And so you, there was like different festivals that would honor different deities of that abundance. Could you tell us a little about the Floralia?
Absolutely. I am obsessed with Floralia. So when I was studying for this deck, I definitely went down a lot of rabbit holes of just research, because I love doing that and learning more. And there's a couple cards where there's the floral wreath. And, you know, so there's the strength card where the woman is wearing kind of a floral wreath.
Yeah.
That she's taming the lion. And then there's the Three of Cups, where they're actually the three figures in that one are also wearing floral wreaths. And I was looking at that as a symbol, kind of breaking it out. I was like, okay, what is the floral wreath tied to? And it definitely can be associated with the goddess Flora, the Roman goddess Flora, who was the goddess of flowers. And because her, you know, the people that would celebrate her back in Roman times would wear floral wreaths. And I, with that, before I got any further in the research, I would have assumed, oh, flowers, that's gentle and innocent and virginal. And I would have assumed her celebrations would be very sweet. And it's not. And I just, I absolutely love this. But I, when I started digging into it, it's like, no, Floralia, which was like a 6-day festival, day and night, like they were partying hard in honor of Flora. And the festival goers would, literally there was, they describe it with lewd acts and nudity, you know, taking off their clothes, sometimes having sex, sometimes like it was wild. It was, it was rivaling, you know, the Dionysus Bacchus stuff. So I just, and I had no idea until I researched that. And I was like, that blew my mind, that that sweet, sweet Flora and her flowers, the goddess of flowers, her people liked to rock. So.
Yeah, I guess that's
which makes sense with the Three of Cups for sure. The Three of Cups, since that's celebration and such, you know. But I also love it with the strength card, because then it makes, to me, it brought almost new meaning to the strength card, because they kind of make that figure seem very innocent who's taming the lion. And in my mind, you can be innocent and also be free, if that makes sense. So you don't have to be innocent and closed off from celebration and joy and lewd acts, if you will.
Because of that, you know like as the tarot was developing in the different countries, and when it was a game and then joined with the pip card system, is generally accepted form of history these days. That pretty much everyone can agree on that, I think.
Right.
And then, you know, there would be these clampdowns in Europe by the local religious authorities about what games you could play and what pictures, you know, could be on these cards and who could be depicted and how they could be depicted, especially with the Pope and the papess, the high priestess, as, you know, at one time considered as a rebellion against, you know, that females couldn't be in the authority system of the Christian church and all that sort of stuff, the papess and the Pope. And so there was that evolution that kind of went through this Christian screening for decades, centuries of, you know, a Catholic oversight or Christian oversight from the local authorities. And so the tarot is very much, at least the Rider-Waite Smith, how they've depicted the symbols. I think, you know, the major arcana, especially, I suppose you could say, you could only really say the major arcana for sure from the start had to go through that screening process of being approved by the local Christian authorities. And so that idea of, you know, that Floralia, that, you know, innocent, but also having those unchristian, you know, you can't have sex outside of marriage, blah, blah, blah stuff. The maiden who is unmarried or virginal, but being depicted as a Floralia disciple.
Right.
Well, that's pretty cool. That's a bit out.
Yeah. I really love that. When you were talking about the Catholic Church, it was just really, I was thinking too about the, it's almost like if you think about like what you were saying, where the screening of trying of really them dictating what could even be shown on like on these cards as a game. And if you think about it, then as it becomes like, is it a sneaky little, a little symbol that's being slipped in there even sneakily of like, oh, sure, we'll make it very chaste and pure. It's just like Three of Cups. It's just three women toasting and having fun, but you know, maybe you don't realize, Catholic Church, that what those floral crowns mean. Maybe there's a little more partying going on that you than you realize, which I love the thought of that it could be a sneaky symbol almost.
Yeah, I think that it you would know, every deck creator has their slant on things. Everyone's got their view on the world. Is there right. something that you wanted to bring out in any of these cards that you felt maybe from the Rider-Waite-Smith deck that was created so long ago in such a different cultural in such different cultural environs? Right. Is there anything that you wanted to bring out or leave out from that deck that is close to your heart? As what am I trying to say? Is there any kind of world viewpoint that you thought wasn't represented in the Rider-Waite-Smith deck that you wanted to make sure was represented in there when you made your?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't want to give myself too much credit for having this idea up front, because it was kind of one of those creative processes that led me to it. But I definitely kind of going back to like what we were loosely talking about earlier, that I have a lot of pride in the fact that the way my deck turned out is very, in my mind, it's a very world inclusive viewpoint of a deck, because there it's not focused on just white faced people. It's not focused. And that's not to put Pamela Coleman Smith down. Obviously she was working for her time and her, you know, the people she's working for, you know, obviously she had to work within those parameters, but very colonial, very, you know, there's the pictorial narratives from the original, you know, Rider-Waite-Smith is very one sided viewpoint. And that shouldn't, and tarot, if anything, should be inclusive. I mean, in my mind, the world should be inclusive, but we're still not quite there yet as a people. We're getting, hopefully making strides, but you know what I mean? Like everybody should be able to love who they want. Everybody should be able to do what they want and be who they want. And it shouldn't, no ethnicity, gender, sexual identity, nothing should be holding anybody back, and nobody should be holding them back. But it's, unfortunately, that's just still too very, I guess that's too naive still, because unfortunately there are, we know there are still very much undertones that are ugly in the world that push against those ideas. So I guess I'm kind of muttering on, but I do take a lot of pride in the fact that that's where my deck landed. I feel like that it is a very open for interpretation for anybody to see themselves in the cards. And that means a lot to me. I even identify with it as a woman, because for example, you know, when you do your birth year and you figure out what tarot card is for that year, you know, so this year is an emperor year for me. And there's a lot of, I have like over 100 decks. I love collecting decks, you know. Yeah, you get me, you feel me. But there's definitely some different skin tones in them and such. And occasionally I've seen an emperor done, maybe not in a overtly masculine way, but 90% of it still is a very kind of stern, white bearded kind of figure, masculine looking figure. And it's hard for me to see myself in that emperor card. But in my emperor card, there's no direct figure. It's just those symbols. And then it becomes me tapping into my divine masculinity. Because I fully have always believed that we all carry divine masculinity and divine femininity within us as humans, regardless of any kind of identity. It may be in different ratios, like you might definitely identify more with divine masculine or more with divine feminine, but those energies are kind of all part of our beings, you know? So does that make sense? I mean, you
yeah,
feel
like... Yeah, like I've been looking at Jungian tarot, well, Jung and tarot recently, right. Very recently, and as part of studying for the professional exam for the Tarot Guild of Australia, which I'll talk more a little bit about afterwards, because you know the certification programs around tarot is always contentious. Well, can be contentious, but I quite like this one that they've got with the Tarot Guild. You know, the anima and the animus in with Jung, you know, that you know, that feminine and the masculine, it was separated and it was quite inflexible when Jung was developing the theories. and when it was being discussed while he was still alive. But, you know, well, later in his life, I've just learned. I'm by no means an expert. You know, gender is becoming more flexible. Gender fluidity is much more understood, recognized, seen. There's more in the world today. It is, well, at least in the parts where you and I are from. And there's a lot more information about it. There's a lot more communities that, you know, understand gender fluidity. And so I was listening to Mary Kay Greer, and she calls that, instead of separating anima and animus, divine masculine, divine feminine, she calls it Anna Mouse. Anima/US. Also sounds like a mouse, which is really cute.
Right, that's what I heard first. I was like, oh, that's cute. But that makes sense to make it more of like one unified word almost. That's really interesting.
Yeah, because then you get to choose what bits are where, rather than, I was born a woman and people perceive me as female, and so therefore I am anima with an animus inside me. I think that's how it works. We can have our own flexibility with gender.
Exactly. Yeah, and I love that, because I definitely identify as, you know, as a woman. That's how I identify. And but that doesn't mean I don't need to tap into my own divine masculine side, because, you know, for different purposes. Like sometimes I could see that, especially with this emperor, I can see the value in being a little bit more bold or action-based, kind of those masculine energies that tend to be more masculine as opposed to the more feminine energies, you know, like, and even just like the way the sun is more masculine compared to the moon. Finding that balance even within myself, you know, and stripping out the fact that I maybe identify on the surface as a woman, it doesn't almost matter. I still want to tap into my own divine masculine side, if that, you know. And I like that we have more ability in this day and age to, like you said, to understand those concepts and understand. I mean, I understand gender fluidity is still a little bit different, because that's sometimes even the way you present to the world in a more fluid way. Probably always, just the way that I identify, present as a woman on the surface, but that doesn't mean I don't want to understand my own masculine side and my feminine side. And, you know, I love that we're in a place where we can, you know, explore that more and understand it a little better in this day and age.
Yeah. So I learned in Germany the sun is female.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting. I just always assumed, just from everything I'd read, like that solar power is more masculine, you know, lunar power is more feminine. I'd never heard that. That's interesting.
Isn't it?
And so is the moon masculine then?
I don't know. Because, you know, I don't know enough about like Northern European, Central European, the differences with all the different, there were so many different peoples there, and they were always like conquering each other. And so I get mixed up with what age, what years different peoples lived in different sections of Europe, and what were the dominant deities or the dominant language in different parts at different times. So I'm just terrible to ask about that. But because I always, think about Freya and the wolf with the moon. And so I can place a little with Central Europe and Northern Europe deities and belief systems. So, yeah.
Right.
But, yeah, that idea of active or external radiation for the masculine and that magnetic, receptive, receiving of the feminine is very much in our vocabulary, in both of our cultures that we're from, that active masculine, receptive or kind of less active feminine, and that's integrated into the tarot. And so it's interesting that, I don't know, I used to have a lot of difficulty with that because of that passive female, you know, like that oppression of where where being a passive female was a good thing was very much about the females were controlled. To be married off, they had to be in a certain state. And to prove that you're in a certain state, you couldn't act in ways that people might assume you might not be in that state. Like you couldn't be boisterous, you couldn't be flirtatious because people might assume that you weren't a virgin.
Right.
You couldn't go out and take things, you couldn't be violent, you couldn't, you know, all these, you couldn't, so that you were a valuable marriage prospect and you'd be paid a handsome sum for swapping the woman for the money. Like that's, I've got this real, thing about being passive and associating that with the feminine. You know, I've got this melded quite strongly, and so I always really struggle with that, with the active masculine, passive feminine. But yeah, so I try and think of it as waves, you know, like radiation or magnetism, electromagnetism.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, no, I totally hear what you're saying, though. I have a lot of issues kind of navigating that myself, as far as my own feelings around just, you know, as a woman feeling kind of angry for womankind and history. I mean, we can go to any culture, any time period, and look at how women have been kind of squashed down and kept very quiet and submissive and pushed, you know, so that kind of passive energy. I see what you mean. It can almost make you feel like the feminine energy is a more negative energy. But I think it's, if you can like almost reframe it into kind of like the way in tarot, like cups is a more feminine suit, because cups by nature are vessels, and like women can be vessels, you know, in the way that they can create inside of their body. Whereas, you know, male can be more like swords and wands, because it's more that more overt, outer energy. I don't know. There's power in the fact that women can and bring something internal and create something from it. That there's a lot of power there. Not just even in being a mother, but even just that concept in energetically, the idea that we can take in energy and transmute it almost into something else, you know, because the whole, I mean, even if you're not an actual mother, you know what I mean? Like just that process of creation from internal, coming, bringing something within, that's, if you think of the feminine energy doing that, then it becomes more of like a power. You know, I don't know, like it's, but it's hard. Sometimes it's hard to reframe it. I get what you mean. It's hard to take that passive, quieter energy, and that's more internal, and not feel like, yeah, that just like we've been told to be, you know, shush, be quiet, be pure, be go, you know, go be secondary to the men, you know, like, you know, it's hard to resolve that historically, for sure.
I love that about the alchemy, you know, that transmutation. I'd not thought of it like that before. About that, even that potential, that possibility, no matter what age of life you are, no matter what age you are or what stage of life you are, that aspect of the feminine is, you know, assumed, and you know, we have space in it for that in our bodies. Like there is, well, see, that's a thing, because that's because that's totally like a cisgender thing, isn't it? Like,
it is but is it? Because if you weren't born with the equipment of a female, but you identify as a woman, as a trans woman, that in my mind, I'm not a trans woman, so I guess I'm speaking, you know, as a more making assumptions of the possibilities, but I would think that there's a lot of sense of owning your womb energy, even if you don't literally have a uterus. Like there's owning that womb, because womb energy, like we're talking about, like bringing something inside and then creating something and having that creation, you know, power as a woman. I mean, in my mind, I definitely want trans women to feel that empowerment of that kind of energy as well, even if they don't actually have like a little organ that's, you know what I mean? Like I would hope that, I would wish that for them, I guess, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And I, you know, and I think we were talking about it a little beforehand, you know, that I'm not very up on trans issues. I'm up on other, you know, issues within the rainbow community. But I love that idea about womb energy. That's really cool. You know,
yeah,
like it reminds me of the chakras in terms of,
yes.
You know, no matter what, there's a root chakra, there's a sacral chakra.
Right. And that sacral, men have a sacral chakra, you know, they have that same region that maybe isn't, you know, directly tied to a uterus, but it's that same region of their body where they can, you know, if they want to work with it in that way, they certainly could. Also, and not to get, I hope I'm not getting too inappropriate for your viewers or listeners, but I love the term, you know, the term big dick energy. And I've always felt like you don't have to be a man or have a penis to have big dick energy. And so what is that? So if you think about it that way, it's like, that's my energetic, you know, energy I'm wielding at the moment is big dick energy. So it's, again, it's not having any actual, like, I don't have an actual penis, but maybe sometimes if I'm feeling bold, I could have big dick energy. Yeah. So I don't know why, you know, somebody who wanted to identify a certain way or harness that energy couldn't have some good womb energy and work with it.
Big womb energy, big vagina energy.
Big womb energy. There you go. I hope that wasn't too much. Big sorry.
I think that's fine. If I'll check and, you know, we can always snip it out.
Edit that out if it got a little too racy.
He said the word penis. So with the symbols in the tarot, and what's the card that you associate or the symbol that you associate with big dick energy? Or, and then what's a symbol that you might associate with big womb energy?
Yes. Oh, these are great questions. I love this. This is a great idea. Yeah. What did you just say? Which one?
Flower. Would the flower be big womb energy?
Maybe. I mean, honestly, if the first things that come to my mind for like big dick energy is that Ace of Wands, big womb energy is that Ace of Cups. I mean, those are kind of the ultimate as far as a vessel and a rod. You know, and those are kind of the ultimate of those suits. But maybe also, I mean, the Empress obviously could be big womb energy. That's definitely some of that kind of creation, maternal, you know, creating kind of energy in that womb space. Definitely the Empress sometimes carries. I mean, the Emperor could definitely bring some, you know, big D energy, I would think, kind of harnessing that, because the Emperor's, you know, pretty much on top of his masculine game of kind of understanding masculine energies and really kind of reigning over that masculine world. So yeah, maybe, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, especially like sitting on top of, you know, the throne, and how the Empress, she has a throne also. But I've thought about, in terms of like, say, if you're going to have a bunch of dots that represent people on a page, okay. And you think about a group of, you know, manly men who identify as manly men. Mm-hmm. And a group of womanly women who identify as womanly women. And I automatically have this, if you're listening, you can't see me, but I've automatically got this circle that my hands are making for mm-hmm. the womanly woman circle. And I've got this triangle for the manly men, which is, you know, the apex up the top is the emperor. And so this hierarchical military structure, you know, this kind of, the one at the top makes the orders that can be life and death, you know, soldier style, you go over here, you sacrifice yourself. I won't get into that, that's a bit too much, but like very hierarchical in terms of someone up the top, two after them, three under that, you know, like going down,
right?
And then
right.
with the female structure of the circle of that, with the Empress card, how she's sitting in nature, she can go anywhere, there's no boundaries, there's no walls around her, she and other empresses can wander around the woods, interact with all the different levels of the forest, of the meadows, of the river, whatever. Whereas the emperor on the throne, I always imagine, I don't have it with me and I can't, you might know it by heart. I always imagine these brick concrete walls around the emperor, and he'll have these, you know, in my mind, he's got these little windows from his castle where the people can shoot arrows from to defend him or whatever. But him being as the king in the chess piece where he's the kind of brain of a logistics unit. I have him very much passive, not cyclical. He's kind of stable. He's always the same. There's almost no seasons with him. Like, he's just in this, like...
And when you brought up the chess, I mean, I can't help but think of chess as an analogy, because the king in chess can barely move. Yes. He's very fixed. He can move a space, but the queen, whoosh, whoosh, can do whatever she wants in any direction and shape. Do you mind if I let my cat out of my office real quick?
Yeah, go for it.
Apologies for that. He was starting to get kind of vocal and I didn't want to invest.
No, I love cats. I love cats. So no, I'm all for assistant cats. Isn't that funny? He kind of demonstrated about that being stuck in a room.
Right.
Like, yeah, I'm stuck in the room. I want to go out. I'm a queen. I'm doing my queenly duties by exiting this room.
Right.
And humans always have to help cats to get in and out of human structures. And that idea of who has the ability to access or control those structures, and therefore, and you know, I'm just kind of rambling here, but that control aspect of the emperor and the empress about the and the king and the queen in chess, it's like, sorry, I'm just really going off on a tangent.
No, but I love it. I actually love the deep, like I'm actually digging it. I'm like, oh, I want to hear more. I'm like, I love it.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So that idea of, because for me, the emperor is very much associated with logistics, with being in control of, being in charge of, having the say over, ensuring the health of logistics and supply lines. And that real physical, you know, reality. And whereas the empress has been placed in very much in nature and doesn't have control over the seasons, doesn't have control over whether the flowers bloom at a certain time or whether the river flows. The river just flows. And of course, as humans, we can interfere and, you know, change things around. Sure. But I really do have that definite, the empress wouldn't interfere. She would let everything decide for itself in harmony with the ecosystem and go out, meet it and check and see what it's doing. Kind of like witchy style, going out and collecting the flowers and, you know, just enough so that the plant can still seed for the next year and all that sort of thing. Whereas the emperor, I feel like he's stuck in this concrete box going, this much flour has to get through or all the peasants will starve. This much, you know, wood has to get through because we need this many wagons and chariots for carrying the flour to the people. You know, like, I don't know what I'm talking about there, but...
there's so many great ways to look at and contrast and compare kind of masculine, feminine energies, you know, from a stance that's not, especially within tarot, it's really kind of a fascinating, you know, how many different ways you can kind of peel back those layers. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah. Before we head off, if you wanted to give a spiel about what products that you have available for people to access and how they can work with you and where they can find you.
Oh, sure. Thank you. Right now I have the biggest deck that I have out right now is Tarot Disassembled, which we've discussed a little bit on the program. And there's only a very few left of the first edition, but I just got done with a Kickstarter campaign about a month ago and funded a second edition that'll be a little bit different with a little bit more sparkle, some foil and things like that, you know, a little bit of bling bling. And then I also came out with kind of a sister deck to that one, which is Tarot Assembled. And that it breaks down those individual symbols and can be used more oracle style or in tandem. There's lots of different ways you could use it. Those are both available for pre-order right now. I have a link tree with kind of all my different links, and that can be found on Instagram, or I know you were maybe going to put it in the notes too.
Yes.
So that there's definitely a link to pre-order if anybody's interested in those. They'll be out, hopefully done printed, I believe early May, late April, so coming soon. And then I have a couple other decks in the works that it's funny. I was kind of explaining to you, you know, a couple of years ago when Tarot Disassembled hit my brain, it really was one of those like ideas where it's like poke, poke, nudge, nudge, everything else out of the way. This, we want to get made first. So I kind of had to follow that muse. And I had two other ideas that I was already kind of exploring that I kind of put on the back burner. So I really want to get back to those. And one is the idea of superpowers, but not in any kind of comic book cheesy way, really more taking maybe inspiration from, you know, stories and movies and literature, but more stripping out those powers. So for example, if you had invisibility as a power, what does that spiritually mean? It could mean either that you maybe you need to tap into your powers of observation and being able to listen and really observe the room. Or maybe it's saying you're not showing up enough and not being bold enough and not showing yourself enough. So like, what could that power mean for you in like a spiritual way, if that makes sense? And then the other one is kind of about poisons. I went to a museum exhibit and I just am fascinated by the concept of so many things, natural substances in the world, plants and animals, even that produce toxins. A lot of those things, they can be very deadly, but they, in the right dosage, they can also be healing. And so there's this interesting duality there that I'm really fascinated with on like a scientific level. So those are kind of the concepts I'm playing with right now for some potential decks that I hope to dive into more soon.
With your decks, you have a lot of research and a lot of knowledge behind them. And that, I love that, because I also love learning, and so that's really drawn me to your work, is the amount of knowledge that's behind these decks. And do you think, like, with the I've actually have ordered your Kickstarter. I'm getting both decks.
Thank you. I didn't realize that. Thank you so much.
I'm avidly waiting for them.
And, right.
And do you think, like, I know there's always a little white book, but, you know, do you have a larger book that comes with them that goes into more depth?
I do. In fact, that was something I found when I started writing the guidebook for the first edition of Tarot Disassembled. I just couldn't shut up. Basically, I found out I've always liked writing just more like, you know, like on my own, not necessarily for anything professional. But I really enjoyed the process of the research and the process of putting it into my own words. And so I can kind of show you a little, very quick little snippet. I'll explain it for the people only listening. But for example, I take a card and I kind of break down each symbol and kind of share some symbols and information about what each individual symbol means. And that's for the Tarot Disassembled. And then I have a glossary of common symbols, because there's a lot of symbols that are that kind of repeat in tarot So I wanted people to have a quick reference for, okay, well, if it's grapes, because I have a lot of cards with grapes in this reading, tell me what grapes as a whole means. So I kind of break the book down into several sections like that. For Tarot Assembled, I plan on kind of doing a deeper dive on those individual symbols, like with storytelling, because one of the things I'm fascinated about is how you can take a single symbol and you can find layers of meaning from different religions, different mythologies, modern day stories. And I just nerd out on that. So I love that. So there'll be a lot of kind of deeper dive on the symbols in the Tarot Symbol Guidebook. It's for the people who can't see, it's about a 5.5 by 8.5 not super thick. It's going to be expanded for second edition. This was first edition. So it'll be a pretty decent little, pretty decent book. This was about 150 pages. I think it'll be closer to 200 for each one separately. So I'm still kind of in the process of finishing the writing on those. But yeah, definitely I couldn't stick to the little white book. I just couldn't. I just couldn't do it. I like to go off on tangents.
But to the benefit of us all, I think. Yeah, because there's several books that discuss the symbolism found in the Rider-Waite-Smith deck, but I don't always identify as being from the same culture or subculture as those authors, whereas stuff that you've written, I relate to. And so I'm kind of looking forward, not kind of, I am looking forward to seeing your research and how you present it through your lens, through your filter. So I'm really quite excited for that project to kind of hit my doorstep, to be delivered to my door.
Oh, that's exciting. Thank you. I'm sorry I didn't realize you were back with that.
Just means I didn't say. No. Yeah, no. Yeah, cool. All right. Well, yeah. All the information about where to find Jennifer will be in the description of wherever you are listening in or watching this podcast, blogcast, videocast. Oh, I don't know.
Oh yeah, blog. That's right, blogcast maybe. Yeah, blogcast.
So thank you so much, Jennifer. On behalf of the Tarot Guild of Australia, we're really honored to have you on the podcast today. Thank you for your time.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. It's just even emailing with you has been a treat, because I think we really vibe on some, a lot of different subjects. So we will have to just have our own little chat sometime.
I would very much like that.
Yeah, we'll have to just nerd out together. But thank you so much, Trish. I really appreciate it. It's been wonderful.
All right then. Well, have a good rest of your day.
Thank you, you too.
Thanks again for listening today. My name's Trish Appleyard. I'm the podcast coordinator of the Tarot Guild of Australia. You can listen to this and all previous episodes by heading to the website tarotguild.org.au. Click on the Articles and Podcast menu item. Episodes are also up on Spotify and YouTube. These TGA Tarot Talk podcasts are monthly, so I hope you can tune in again next month. Until then, best wishes.